Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, Egg Chasers. It's the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously, and we are back here. Welcome. The Rugby Dungeon has been turned into a rugby boardroom.
Indeed,
as we try and solve all of the off-field issues going on in the game this last week. We're all wearing blazers right now.
I like your blazer, Tim.
Thank you very much. I've gone for the die young, go all out or go home.
Exactly.
Full number ones.
I tell you who else is a very well-dressed man for rugby. Alan Solomons.
Ah, okay.
He's always in a blaze. He's always got a pin badge on. I like that.
Yeah, home and away. It's something like Dai Young is different away from home to home. When he's at home, he's in full shirt, tie, sometimes waistcoat.
Mm.
Beautiful. Looking excellent.
Looking good.
I haven't got the guts to ask him. I want to know what size chest is that jacket?
Ask him. You'll probably appreciate it.
60 inches. Maybe more.
It's really incredible. He's an unbelievable specimen of a man.
I'm trying to think of
Alan Solomons always wears home and away. He'll wear that nice tweed.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think. Like a lot of coaches dress as if they're PE teachers, don't they? So like Dimes is always in tracksuit pretty much for match day.
Joe Schmidt,
Jordan Murphy, Joe Schmidt, Mark McCall.
Yeah. It isn't. I guess it's one of those things. Like it's kind of like working from home. Like you just get into your shorts and that's it.
What does Chris Boyd wear? I can't remember.
I don't know.
Normally tracksuit, I think. I often think of him in being in like a hoodie.
I tell you who doesn't wear a tracksuit.
Yeah, you might be right, actually, yeah.
I tell you who doesn't wear a tracksuit. David Humphreys.
No.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure David Humphreys has always been a suit.
He's now in the more corporate role, isn't he?
Yeah.
In the DRR role compared to Ackerman, who's always in the
tracksuit. Tracksuit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. But Ackerman is the most... Ackerman gets involved in the warm-ups more than any other coach.
Him
and Todd Blackadder, actually, are both like running, getting out and in amongst it. They love it. You can see they're just desperate to get involved.
Yeah. Someone goes down, they're thinking, do I lace up?
Right.
So one just on the DOR thing, two DORs, or two head coaches, both use the same phrase this weekend. It's an unusual phrase.
Let the boys play.
Not let the boys play. It was... They pulled our pants down.
Oh, right.
Can you tell me which two? They've worked with each other as a clue.
It will be... Okay, so it will be the
Saracens.
Paul Gustard.
Gustard,
Alex
yeah.
Sanderson.
No, not Sanderson. It was Gustard and Eddie Jones.
Ah.
Eddie Jones referencing the last time they played Scotland. He said they pulled our pants down.
Yeah,
I just thought it was a weird turn of phrase for them both to use
it
on the same
weird
weekend.
Turn of phrase that I've not heard for, thank God it's died. It lasted 1 week. Resourcing the ball. I was watching Quinn's Gloucester. And resourcing the ball did not come up once.
Thank God.
Thank God that's over before we even started.
Right, agenda for this meeting, gentlemen, in the boardroom is one, World League announcement from World Rugby. Two is salary cap. Three is drinking in stadiums, and four is any other business.
Yes, good.
So one, World League from World Rugby. So there was the quote-unquote leaked plan, which, as everyone knows by now, was no promotion relegation for some 10 years, excluded Fiji, but included USA.
Japan and USA.
I get the whiff. And then a few days later, World Rugby have released what their actual plan is. I don't see, and a lot of people leapt to the conclusion that World Rugby had hastily arranged something which, as a PR exercise. I don't know how you can come up with the plan that they have come up with hastily.
They've been working on it for years. Well, not years, a year, months.
So they actually say in their statement that their plan was the one that was tabled to the CEOs of the individual unions in September 2018. So it has been a significant period of time before that this has been prepared.
Which says to me there's been potentially some, like, there's something that must leave a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth with the way that that leak came out. Because basically, and what I'm inferring from that is that leak was never got to a point where they were actually seriously giving it to the nations as this is what we want to do.
Exactly. It was malicious. It was there to damage World Rugby, and that's what whoever did this, that's what they intended to do. And they successfully did it.
And they did. And the amount of blowback that World Rugby received as a result.
Yeah. And it's amazing because they make World Rugby look like some sort of pariah. And they're far from that. You know, they're one of the greatest forces for good in the international game. And they do genuinely care. They are trying to get the lower nations rising as high as they can, more competitive games. That's why we've had so many changes in coaching structures and, you know, fixtures and autumn tours where, you know, you've got to play at least one game against an emerging nation. So, you know, I thought it was a very unfair characterisation of what World Rugby are trying to do.
And what I would add to that is, in terms of relegation promotion, World Rugby have absolutely no control over that, because that is going to be at the mercy of the stakeholders, which are the nations, which ultimately, and it's rumoured, Italy and Scotland. I think I've jumped ahead, actually. We should very briefly explain, for anyone that hasn't seen, go on, Phil, what World Rugby have actually proposed.
So it's similar. It certainly follows the same format as the original leak, but there are a few key differences. First of all, the International Rugby Player Council, who leaked it initially, said that there would be no promotion or relegation. The format that World Rugby have tabled would have promotion and relegation. So it would have two tournaments of 12 teams each. Each team plays the other, so plays 11 games, home or away, across the full year,
yeah,
with the Six Nations and Tier 2 Six Nations and ARC and Rugby Championship games counting towards that.
With that does mean, with the semi-final and final, that does mean there is an increase in the number of games international sides play.
Potentially, but it depends which fixture list you take. Because I've seen some, like Argentina a couple of years ago played 18 games in a season. This would take it to 13 games, which for some teams, some years, a maximum of 13 games, which for some teams for some years would be an increase. It would also, in the potential version, which is one of the things that the International Rugby Players Council flagged, it could lead to 5 back-to-back-to-back-to-back games in autumn,
yeah,
which currently no schedule has 5 international calibre games running
so
back-to-back.
It's still not perfect. I'm interested in what you think about the suggestion that there is an up-and-down mechanism between the leagues via a playoff. So in the Six Nations case, say this season, let's say Italy finished bottom, would play off against the top team in the Rugby Europe Championship, which I think is Georgia.
Yeah.
And they would play off to... Now, you were dead against this, JB.
Yes, like, I still am.
Yeah.
So I don't... On one hand, I give them credit for thinking about this sort of structure. How do you get more competitive games to more nations? Good. Okay, I like it. The problem is they've just sort of moved the problem a bit. So you've got 2 lots of 12 team leagues, or 4 lots, whichever way you want to, you know, dice it up. But what happens if there's another team outside of that wants to come in?
That's included.
No, it's not.
It does. It is. It goes down lower than that.
Oh, I've not seen...
Yeah. There are smaller conferences at the third tier level.
Ah, I wasn't aware of that.
So it goes top to bottom. I think every team in World Rugby is included in this pyramid.
Right. So, I mean, I'm still on my original opinion, though, that I like smaller conferences. And when I say conferences, I don't mean like this formal structure. I like the formality of a Six Nations or a Rugby Championship or Rugby Championship Europe competition, whatever that thing's called. The Tier 2 Six Nations, for want of a better word. I like that. That's what I like, because you can build your own rivalries. I've been over it a million times before. But I like it.
That doesn't match with what you just said, which is what I don't like. That what about other clubs that want to get into that? Well, you can't build those rivalries between Georgia, Romania, Spain, Belgium, whoever's Germany, if you exclude everyone else.
Okay, so
how does that work? What I think this actually is a good model to solve. To solve all of that?
No, because you're missing out a few things there. So they still have their competitions. So you can't get promoted or relegated from the Six Nations. That's always going to stay. The Six Nations games just count towards whatever you're doing. What I was saying is I like the mix of formal and informal. So you have the guys in the Tier 2 Six Nations and they stay as they are. If you want to get another competition on top of that, well, that stays as that is.
So what a Lithuania... Right, let's say...
And then you have the informal... Lithuania,
Lithuania elect a president who's a massive rugby fan and channels loads of national money into rugby because he wants to make them a rugby superpower in 20 years' time.
Cool.
Oh, you can't, because you can't join one of the conferences. You can, so long as you carry on playing with Croatia and Poland.
I'm kind of happy for like some natural realignment to go on. I just don't think it's always necessarily the best way. We looked at Italy again this week, who got battered against like 14 of the last 20 Six Nations or whatever it is, they've come last. Now, my point would be that just by putting a team in the company of better competition does not necessarily lead to an improvement. And I think we should look at Italy and think maybe this isn't the best road for Georgia or any other emerging nation.
Well, I think you're not thinking big enough, because as I said, what incentive is there in the current model for funding to be seriously delivered in potential future star rugby nations like Poland or Lithuania?
What is the incentive? I don't think there's any incentive, is there, other than the charity of World Rugby, which is exactly what happens at the moment.
So in the UK right now, if your sport is not Olympic sport, you do not get central funding.
No, you don't.
So it has the aspiration to be the best in the world, as measured by the top of the tree, which is the Olympic Games, it directly affects the funding that you get. And it's the same in rugby.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because that's just how they make it. So rowing, yes, we will give you money as a rower, because you could potentially win an Olympic medal. And if there's
I don't really follow along on that, because I actually thought that the funding... Unless I'm wrong, I thought the funding for the big nations comes from the big tournaments. So, and actually, it doesn't really matter if you're an emerging nation, because you'll get your funding from World Rugby.
You misunderstand my point. Germany have come through as an emerging nation because of private funding.
Yeah.
Right? That sort of thing would be more likely.
So what you're saying...
That sort of thing would be more likely to happen if there is the aspiration of
what you're saying
elite performance.
Yeah, if they're doing really well in... say Lithuania, where is the incentive for that private money to come in if you're not going to make the Six Nations?
Or government money, whatever it is.
I see that in its entirety, but I still go back to the fact that I think, you know, the incentive should be incremental. So like every time that Georgia get a bit better, I'd like to see that be reflected in Spain, and it has, and be reflected in Germany, which it actually has, and same with Romania. So every time one of them gets a little bit better, they all get a little bit better, rather than just take one of them out of their comfort zone, put them straight in Six Nations like Georgia, and watch them get thumped for the next 20 years.
What would be the difference between a year of Georgia in the Six Nations and a year of Italy in the Six Nations?
Absolutely nothing, and exactly. That's the problem.
Well, so get rid of Italy altogether, go five nations then?
I do wonder if that might be an option. I mean, it might be better for their rugby to be competitive, and then, you know, increase if Italy spent every year outside of the Six Nations those last 20 years getting 5% better each and every year, they would be a genuine Tier 1 nation. At the moment, they're sort of like tier 1A. You know, they're not quite Tier 1. They're not quite.
This feels like it's gone down a rabbit hole where we're going back. Let's talk about World Rugby's proposals. I think it's the most together suggestion that they could have come up with.
It's definitely the best suggestion that I have seen. Not what I would do, but it's, you know, it ticks a lot of boxes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's a very, very difficult problem to solve. As in, you're trying to solve multiple problems at the same time. Because you're trying to solve the global game structure, you're trying to solve the player welfare, teams playing too much, you're trying to solve getting smaller teams opportunity to compete against the bigger teams, but not too much opportunity and not disproportionate. You're trying to create more games between the bigger nations that mean more, so that it's not a England playing South Africa four times in a row with nothing on the line kind of game. So you're trying to solve all of that in one solution. And this, it's not perfect.
Right.
But it seems like a good attempt.
There's definitely a better attempt than I've seen previously.
Yes. Yeah. And I think actually we've maybe just slightly got bogged down in the existing rugby fan bubble.
Like which is
we're thinking about this as people that are already invested in the game.
Rather than potentially new
any
markets.
Potential rugby fan who isn't into rugby understands the structure of sport, whether it be conferences, leagues, a sort of pyramid. Everybody understands that concept. And I think what we need to remember is, and if you're listening to this right now as well, there's every chance you are just like us, already invested and would watch come what may. But that's not the case for other sports. That's not the case for broadcasters of other countries. That's not the case for sponsors who aren't already invested in the game as well. And you suddenly create a structure where there is merit, there is a pyramid, there is something tangible on the line. I know that the argument loads of rugby fans give is, well, I've never watched an autumn international that's actually friendly. Mm. Yes, but you're thinking of someone who's already a rugby fan.
Yeah.
Think about someone in Atlanta in America who hasn't watched the game before and could be a fan, or someone in Poland who could watch rugby. When there's a structure that they get, that brings in people, that brings in broadcasters, that brings in sponsors, and that's what we want. And I think it's really narrow-minded to try and be protectionist about rugby because it's a small sport and the values that rugby brings, we should want to spread as far and wide as possible.
Yeah. I mean, the irony of this is, of course, if you're a football fan, you look over to rugby and say, I really wish that we had a Six Nations. And they've got a really
well, they've sorted out they've got a Nations Cup now, haven't they?
Yeah.
Which is done over two years.
Yeah. Six Nations. But yeah, okay. But you know, that's where that's come from, is this longing for what we have. I mean, I think everyone has that longing. It's one of the great sports tournaments, you know, in the world, frankly.
It is, but it's how do you get that to more people? Yeah. And that is another big question that World Rugby are trying to answer by doing this.
I think if you want things to stay as they are, I question how much of a rugby fan you really are.
Oh, well, I do want it to stay the way it is. I genuinely think it is
and what I mean by that is you don't want players or fans or potential patrons or businessmen or sponsors in countries that aren't already where they are to have an incentive or any reason to get involved.
No, I just think, I mean, going over the same ground, I just think it is not based. It's like the pro, you know, look at what the Pro 14 is going through, or look what Super Rugby went through. Just by broadening out your tent and getting all these new teams in who don't have a history, and you're making up, I don't know, the bloody East, the East Queensland Wildcats, you know, and you know, it's starting from scratch, and they've got no history. Nobody cares. But if it grows organically through, you know, a rivalry between, you know, Spain and Portugal should have a cracking rivalry, or you know, Russia, Georgia. I think that's how it builds. It builds gradually and slowly. It can't be like this big bang. It'd be like trying to put an NFL team in the UK with UK players only and playing in the NFL. It would just not work. So I don't think it's possible.
But yeah, okay, fine.
It is interesting because I think, so in order for the funding, something different has to be done. To solve all those problems, I said, won't go over them, but to solve all those problems, something different has to be done. And this is an attempt to do something different. I'm probably more with you, Tim, where I think this is a probably sensible, albeit not perfect, attempt to do something different. I think that I would actually be concerned, not really, but I think it could have the opposite effect, and it could actually end up turning off some of the existing fans and not bringing in those new fans, which is probably what you're kind of alluding to with the Super Rugby thing, Jay, with half-empty stadiums or fully empty stadiums.
Yeah, I mean, Sunwolves doesn't seem to me to really risen the profile of rugby too much in those in the countries where it operates.
Hey, they beat the Chiefs.
Yeah. Well, but hold on, if there's no more or less rugby, if that is the case, there's no more or less rugby, because the problem with Super Rugby is there's way more rugby than it can actually.
I'm not saying I'm right, by the way. I'm just saying this is what I suspect. And I tell you the other thing, which we haven't really, no one's discussed, is where do you get the players from? Because you know, England, everyone talks about the academies. It's not really the academies that provide, you know, the bulk of the expertise at schoolboy level. It's these private schools, which are basically factories of coaching. You know, the likes of which nobody else has. Ireland has the same thing. A lot less so in Scotland, there's disadvantages of, you know, Wales has its club game. But, like, not even, you know, France can't compete with the English schools. They can't compete with the Irish schools. God knows how Romania would do it. Or, you know, Madagascar or someone.
Maybe have a structure which incentivizes more cash being injected into programs. How do you get schools to
play it? I think that's the question, is that how do you get kids to play it? Because you need to be good as a kid. You need these players coming through at 18, nearly ready to play Premiership rugby.
Maybe have broadcasters who go, oh, right, so hold on. If we win this league, we might go up to the... We have a playoff to get into the top tier and play against all the massive sides. All right, yeah, we'll put that on prime time then.
Yeah, I think World Rugby would love that. I think, you know... I just don't think that it'd make enough money. So that's I've still not changed my my opinion on the structures. But yeah, you know, I do appreciate what World Rugby have done. I think it's a really good idea. I think it's a healthy idea.
What was interesting was to see Conor O'Shea endorse it, because what was spoken about was that the stakeholders were the ones that were going to be the gatekeepers here. It's not actually World Rugby's decision to decide or go with it. They can only suggest it. And the Six Nations stakeholders, namely Italy and Scotland, were thought to be the barriers. And Italy might have written themselves off as being one of the barriers. They might be embracing it.
Yeah. Certainly Conor O'Shea. And I actually think, having lost, was it 21 Six Nation games on the bounce for Italy, I think a couple of seasons of actually winning 80%+ of your games would do a world of good for that Italy
team. But it's
team.
Not going to do any good for the team coming up. It's going to be like the guys coming from the Championship.
Yeah.
The Premiership.
Would Scotland do it?
No, and they
Scotland
shouldn't.
Will sign up for it.
Not only no,
they should.
B no, yeah. C I don't think it's going to help. And also last one, if Conor O'Shea's lasting legacy, right, is because he's a good bloke and he believes in fairness and so on and so forth, he removes Italy from the Six Nations. They never get back there.
Well, no, what I thought when I saw Conor O'Shea, that was like, that is so Conor O'Shea, because with Italy he is embarking on a long-term vision. He hasn't made decisions which will benefit him in the short term. He is making decisions which he thinks and he believes there's a blueprint to bring up the quality of the Italy team in the longer term. And I think when he talked about the World Rugby plans, he is seeing the bigger picture longer term, not making short-term decisions, which is what, if Scotland refuse it, I believe Scotland will be doing that to the detriment of everybody. So Scotland... take a lead from Conor O'Shea and go with it. The only other thing with the World Rugby proposal that's probably worth mentioning is what happens in a Lions year and a World Cup year. In a World Cup year, it doesn't happen. In a Lions year, it still happens, but there's no promotion or relegation.
Ah, so I was reading it that it would only happen in non-Lions and non-World Cup years.
No.
Okay.
It will still happen in a Lions year, but there'll be no promotion relegation.
Right.
Which... I would have liked, being as that's in between World Cup years, that's the halfway point, I would like to propose something to World Rugby that one, you don't do the same league structure and you actually have a bit more effort to play teams that you wouldn't normally play against in the top 12 and middle 12. You have chucking a couple more cross-tier games.
Because that's one of my concerns, that so two tiers of 12... Let's just say there are 10 tier 1 nations. Scotland are maybe a tier 1A or 1B or whatever you want to call it. Sorry, Italy are tier 1A, 1B. So there'd be two non-tier 1 nations in the top who would play every single one. So they get, so you get two teams who get loads of exposure to the big teams. Everyone else gets no exposure to the big teams other than in World Cup.
Yeah.
So it's, it actually exacerbates a problem that already exists in rugby for some teams and makes it much better for a couple of lucky ones or unlucky ones, depending on how you view it.
Yeah, so that's what I thought. The Lions year could be an effort, an effort to kind of reach out there.
That's that. If it's going to happen, that would be a sensible option.
Watch this space. We'll see. Agenda one, still, there's still lack of, you know, there's still...
Kick it into the long grass. We'll deal with it next meeting.
Exactly. We'll, what have they been calling it? Kick the can down the road.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take it right up to the wire with the deadline.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, agenda point two, salary cap.
Yeah, okay.
So there's the Daily Mail had a story last week, which...
You say they had a story.
they printed an article. They published, printed an article. Published an article.
They printed an expose on the salary cap, and namely Saracens and Nigel Ray's business arrangements with some of his players. Yeah.
So I mean, some might say they did a month-long expose. Others might say they listened to our podcast and spent £1.50 on a company's house search. I don't know, okay? I don't know. But that's what some might say. So nothing particularly explosive here. So I've been around, and we're not going to go over the salary cap rules. We're going
to
do any.
No. There's a whole podcast dedicated to the salary cap. Go back in our feed and listen to it. I think it was one of our best podcasts, actually. Yeah. So go and listen.
Everything I'm about to tell you now is completely new. Okay, you've not heard any of this before. What I did is I kind of listened to what the Daily Mail was saying, and basically they were saying that Saracens set up companies. Now, we mentioned companies, but we did not mention property companies, and
We mentioned how proactive Saracens were at setting up, at helping players set up businesses.
Yeah, so now there's a bunch of companies, and they're called very imaginative things like Farrell Investments and stuff like that.
Faz Investments, yeah. Voonprop.
Voonprop, yeah, Voonprop.
Wiggy Nine Investments.
Yeah, so these are not super secret. You know, if you think you've got the smoking gun because you've unveiled these, not so much. But it did lead me down some rabbit holes. So I spoke to a couple of people in the game who, are very senior in clubs. Don't mind saying that. And basically, what I've come to is I think all the clubs are squeaky clean. That might shock you.
Well, to go back to the podcast we did previously, there were lots of things that we covered, a lot of ground we covered in that, which showed that the regulations since the previous salary cap issues, maybe 5 years ago, were very, very much tightened up. Yeah. And there's a lot of scrutiny on it.
The clubs themselves, the entity of the club, Sale Sharks Limited, Saracens Limited, whoever it is, you're not going to find any issues there. You're also not going to find any issues with a company set up called Farrell Investments.
Faz Investments.
Yeah, it would be stupid. But that is not to say there is not underhand stuff going on. It's just that I can't prove it. This is just hearsay. So we've all heard the hearsay previously about, Rolex watches, which again is a magnificent way to do it because you get around all sorts of money laundering regs and so on and so forth.
Farmland in South Africa.
Houses. Shopping vouchers to wives, houses, you name it, it's been said. There's a few things. So if you wanted to be super sneaky, the way you get around the cap is between the owner and the player. And the owner would have to set up an offshore company himself. He would then have to transfer wealth from one of his existing companies to the offshore company, and then the offshore company would transfer that to the player. That would work, and you could not prove it because Premier Rugby has no jurisdiction to look at either what owners are doing or what players are doing.
So, yeah, so
and they shouldn't sign it.
This is your bread and butter. You're a financial advisor. Obviously, you're very, very scrupulous.
Yes,
and have a lot of integrity in what you do. So, just for argument's sake, so this wouldn't be allowed, and this would surely show up if Nigel Ray said to me, Tim, let's set up a property company. We're 50% shareholders. Oh. Put in a quid each, and we can acquire 50% shares. And then he purchases a house in Harpenden for £1 million. And at some point down the road, several years later, we liquidate the company, sell the house, and I take away £500,000. I couldn't do that.
Well, I don't know, is the answer. I'm just giving you the outline, okay? That offshore route would be absolutely fine. That would be dead easy to do for an accountancy practice. Fine, done. It is cheating. You get caught, you're done.
What about if this was? What about if what I just said was in UK? Okay. In UK,
you just need to go back a step. Particularly with Saracens, I have no proof that this is what they're doing. Zero. But this is what I believe that they could do, and I think it's smart. If you think about the players they have, who they want to keep, they are all long-term players. They all qualify for marquee status.
So you're talking the Vunipolas, Owen Farrell, Mario Itoje, Jamie George.
Yeah.
They can only have two marquee players.
Yes, they can.
Two at any one time.
So if you then had someone...
So this is you brainstorming what you would do if you owned Saracens.
Speaking widely. But you could potentially do this. You could turn the salary cap or the marquee player into a mechanism that doesn't just give money away. So if you're my marquee player, I can give you as much money as I want. I submit that to PwC. They tick the box. Away you go. It doesn't matter. It could be £6 million. Doesn't matter. You'd be mad, but you could do it. Instead of doing that, you turn the marquee player into a mechanism that keeps the player in there. If I had a property company in the UK, a completely legitimate one, I would say, in this year, I am going to make you, Tim, a co-director of my property company, which is going to cost me £1 million. You say, okay, off we go. We submit that as a benefit in kind to PwC. They sign it off because, of course, it's just, you just look at the value of that. It doesn't matter. You're the marquee player. But I've retained shares in it, which means I retain control over the company or some of the company and, of course, of you. So in that year, I can pay you in that company, but going forward, because I have control, I'll also have influence over what you're doing. So this year I can do you, Tim. Next year I'll do you, Phil. The year after that we'll do someone else. The year after that we'll do someone else. So it's perfectly reasonable that Saracens could have done this. I mean, there's no reason why they couldn't, and it would be completely in the law.
And is there you're purely speculating as a financial advisor, the mechanisms which they might be able to do that. Like, what's wrong with that?
Well, it's very inventive if that's what they are doing.
But what's wrong with that? Because they could just have paid in the as a marquee player. Yeah. They could just have paid a big pile of cash.
There's nothing
wrong. A huge briefcase with £5 million in.
Well, you wouldn't even need to do that. It could be perfectly legal.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. They could do that anyway.
And now the problem is with it, of course, that everyone else hasn't thought of it, so it's unfair. But it's not unfair
because it's within the it's well above board within the rules.
And going back to in a lot of these cases, what is looking after a player's long-term post-playing career by enabling them to have helping them with businesses or whatever, as we've already said, is what a great thing to do for a player's future.
Exactly. And I think other club owners get annoyed about this because from their point of view, they're thinking, why can't I afford this damn player? This player from Australia wants so much money when actually an equivalent player who's English can go to Saracens for less. And there are legitimate reasons. So, the actual network of the Saracens community has an intrinsic value to a player who is English who might want to settle in such a lovely part of the world. Whereas if I'm an Australian coming over, it's just cash. The only benefit I can give you is cash.
Actually, coming to what? I can live in London and it's going to cost me how much? Actually, no, I'll come to Sale because Manchester's a bit cheaper.
Exactly.
I can take more back to South Africa when I go back there in 3 years.
There's another thing that Saracens do as well. which I can confirm, it's been widely reported, and this is fascinating. When you join Saracens, you fire your agent. Are you aware of that?
I wasn't aware of that.
Is this fact?
Okay. Yes, this is fact. Okay.
So, well, in every case, what are you saying? In some cases?
Pretty much. Right, so there's three ways to pay an agent.
How do you know this? I mean, I know there was some talk this was in the Mail article.
No, this is... Owen Slot has reported it in the Times.
Oh, yeah.
This started happening under Ed Griffiths.
Just checking your work in.
And on this is really interesting. An agent will cost you somewhere between 5 to 10%. And there's three ways that you pay an agent. Okay. Number one is I pay the agent as the player. I pay it out of my pocket. Don't really want to do that. Particularly when I work out, I'm paying him £35,000 a year on my 350. Well, more than that, actually, because it could be in the 17% bracket.
Yeah.
So it goes up 17, but it could be 15, 10, 5, yeah. So 10%, 35,000. That's a lot of change to find. So instead, the club will pay that on your behalf. Not that it matters, because it goes against the cap. You don't have to pay income tax on it, but fine. And also, so does the VAT. You remember that Wasps got caught with that.
Yeah.
Those are the first two ways to pay an agent. The third way to pay an agent is I get my agent friend, Phil, to tap up Tim, who belongs to another agent. That way, the agent is working on my behalf, not Tim's behalf, and therefore, it's not a P11D benefit. And you can then come to me. We fire the agent, or you never engage him in the first place. And when it's time for you to renegotiate your contract, you just go to the top commercial lawyer in the City of London. Because quite frankly, if you've got 35K to spend, that's what your agent's taking, you could get the top barrister in Manchester to write your contract for you. Not an issue. So Saracens, in effect, will save something like £350,000 a year on agents' fees. So these are the things. If you want to talk about, you know, how to be smart, that's pretty smart.
What is also smart is develop players and have the coaching quality that Saracens have had over the last however long, bring through with the number of academy players they have to the point where they have 1.2 million extra above the cap to spend on players because they've generated their own homegrown
academy
talent.
Credits, homegrown. Yeah.
I also was lucky enough to speak to someone who does audits. I'm not going to say for who or where, but it was illuminating. So a couple of ways that you would look at who might be cheating the cap. One might be, find out where a player lives and check who has the beneficial ownership of the house. So, you know, if next door was, Danny Cipriani, for instance, it might be worth checking the land registry to see who owns that house. Therefore, you could, you know, that'd be one way.
But hold on, haven't you already said there's nothing wrong in any of this, or would that be...
No, that would be a legitimate... that could be a breach, yeah.
So yeah, that would definitely be a breach.
Yeah, it depends. Does the cost of housing come in the contract? If it is no, then it is a breach. If it is a yes, then it's not a breach. Of course, you'd never know.
But what if it's part... What if it's got someone else's name on it, but part of a property company? Not an individual.
Well, it depends. I mean, are they renting the house?
Yeah.
So
if Faz is living rent-free in a million-pound house in Harpenden or St Albans that is owned by a property company that Nigel Ray has
surely
his fingers in, then that would be an issue because that should come under his...
This sort of forensic level scrutiny will have been applied, and if it hasn't, it will be being applied now.
Well, not so much.
Maybe I mentioned that
for a reason. The other thing that is really interesting, which I hear has been employed before, I'm not sure if it still is now, is interviews with players. So I'm not sure if PwC are doing this now, but they sit the player down and they interview a random selection of players. Some clubs are happy.
This happens currently.
Used to happen.
Right.
Some players come in, they get asked a few questions. Some players are allowed in on their own. I guess if you're an academy guy with just straightforward contract, you'd be fine. Other players would request to be sat with a commercial director. So, you know, you can tell something might be up there. But here is the best suggestion that I have had for opening up a bit more transparency, which is when a club makes an offer to a player, it should be a transparent offer. Because then we could ask good questions, couldn't we? Like, why do you, Tim Cocker, not want to come to me when my offer is £500,000 and your next offer on the contract is £300,000?
I want to win trophies.
Fine. For £200,000?
Yeah, I want to win trophies.
You know?
There you go. That's not going to stack up.
Yeah, but Tim, you play at Worcester.
it's the cost of living's cheap round here.
Yeah, I mean, look, you might, and you know, it might be fascinating because
it's on the M5. I can get yeah. You know, I'm equidistant between Exeter and Manchester.
The wife really likes it here. You know, there are so many good reasons why, but at least it's sketched out for you. Like, maybe there is a premium. You know, we call it the European Champions Premium, where you as a player have to take a little bit, a discount.
Discount
to work at Saracens. And maybe that's then completely legitimate because everybody does it. But an open offer market would be fascinating.
In NFL, everyone's salaries is completely transparent.
Transparent. And in a lot of cases, there's a structure to it. So if a player plays for X number of years, there's a minimum amount he will be guaranteed.
I would like that because it would make our conversations on whether players are value for money. You're a lot more weight behind that conversation, and it would certainly show if anyone was if there were a load of people being paid a lot less than what you thought their market value would. It either would not happen for very long, or it would highlight that something dodgy is going.
Yeah, or it's a bad deal. You know, we're holding Jed Glynn's feet to the fire and Simon Cohen's feet to the fire for bad recruiting. Well, we don't really know, do we? You know, we don't know what constraints they were put under. You might find out that they inherited a ton of bad contracts, and actually they're doing their very best to get those guys off the payroll and replace them with cheaper guys. You just don't know. So it'd be a great way for us to analyse the game a bit more. There's obviously privacy issues too.
And the NFL is centralised. These are private companies who are all standalone. And I think what I would say is, after the transgressions in the past that went unpunished, the rules were tightened up, and there is forensic level examination of everything that you can legally and legitimately see. I generally have no issue with clubs looking after their players.
No, I'm with you.
And setting them up for the future.
And can I just add this? I have found, and I have spoke to a lot of people this week, a lot. Ex-players, people still in the game, people in executive positions, all sorts. And there has been speculation that things have been going on in the past. No one doubts that. But I actually do think the game, financially, is pretty clean at the moment. And I would bet my house, crikey, on the clubs themselves being cleaned.
Bet your wife's house.
Yeah, exactly. on the clubs being clean. Now, are there some transactions by owners? I wouldn't like to say, but I don't think there is. I don't think there is.
The tough thing is they're private individuals. Who are you? Who is anyone to stop you, Jay, from saying, Tim, I want to start a business with you and...
I
understand.
Thing is, they've signed up to it. You know, like lots of people are private individuals everyone's a private individual. But you go down a certain road. If you're a solicitor or a lawyer or a doctor or something like that, you sign up to a professional code of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Or in my case, in my line of work, we can only charge in certain ways. And I just think if you're going to go down the route of professional rugby player in the Premiership, and this is the group, this is the group and the rules that the competition have set, that'll be that. And if you're found cheating, I don't really hold the player responsible. But I think the owners need to suffer a public reprimand. I think it's got to be more than financial. I think probably points, and it's all about points and reputational damage for me.
So there was another bit after the Daily Mail article. There was Ryan Walkinshaw.
Yes.
But a series of tweets kind of suggesting some of the things that you've hinted at there.
And talking that in the past.
Yeah.
Talking
in the past.
Because he'd never specifically said that. And I think that is quite an important piece that was missing.
Yeah.
So he sold Gloucester in February 2016.
Yeah.
And he was talking in the past when we did know that these kind of things go on. Or did go on. I think I'm probably with you, Jay, where based on my understanding, I think the clubs, and your explanation very, very good. The clubs are squeaky clean, and there's no way the clubs could not be squeaky clean. If someone were to do one of the routes you're suggesting, it would be very difficult for the league to find out. Now, there'd be interesting questions on probably HMRC from exactly. me. Like, because income tax fraud is assessed based on people living beyond their means.
Well,
and if Owen Farrell's reported salary was £100,000 and he's living in a £2 million house.
But reported to who?
Well,
so there could be
two sets of books being cooked.
Well, no, because they're not asking for players' tax returns. All they're asking for are the contracts and the books of the clubs, right? But Owen Farrell is not cheating his taxes.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, Owen Farrell is. Dave Smith, who plays fly half for Harlequins, right? He might get another £1 million from an owner and just pay the tax on it, but no one's ever going to find out because
that's the bit that stuff would just not be transparent.
It wouldn't be transparent, but like
to the league, but it would be completely transparent to HMRC. But the two wouldn't talk to one another.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not interconnected.
Interesting.
Hope that's made more sense. So I'm going to make two predictions now. Where the Mail is going to go next on this, just to really, muddy the waters a bit. The next, unless they regurgitate something which we said today, which they might do, I don't know. My guess is this is going to go the way of tax avoidance. I think they're going to bring up tax avoidance next, and I think it's going to be low level tax avoidance in these companies, some like personal service companies or something, where people are taking out dividends rather than income tax. So hear me now, believe me later. That is the next scandal that they're going to try and sell on you.
There we go.
See, the guy who took my job at XFM, Chris Moyles, he was just found to be a second-hand car salesman in a little tax scheme buying second-hand cars.
Was it? Now, was this the same as the Olympians? Do you know what they did?
No.
So the Olympians... the Paralympians, when you buy a vehicle and you're disabled, you get it free of VAT if it has the right adjustments to it. So they were buying, I think the guy was like in the British archery team, he was buying fleets of Range Rovers, like with pulleys in them, getting a screwdriver out, getting,
taking out the pulley.
Yeah. Saving the VAT and then putting them back onto the main market.
Well.
Yeah, people went to jail. I think it was the fencing team and an archer. But apologies to British fencing and archery if that was incorrect.
Agenda point 3. Drinking in stadiums.
More next.
a lot was said over the weekend. People complaining about people saying, excuse me, to get to the bar during a game, saying, why would you spend £95 to go and watch England play only to then spend half the game at the bar?
Well, okay. If you spent half the game at the bar, statistically, you could watch a whole game of rugby because ball in play time is about 36 minutes. So when people whinge about, they're standing up, I mean, the chances are if you stand up randomly in a rugby game, there's no rugby happening. So don't worry too much about that. It's just another thing to whinge about. And I like to think about this the same way as I think about vegetarians. And that is to say that you don't need many vegetarians in an office for when... the office party comes along that half the pizzas in the office are now vegetarian pizzas. No one eats them, no one does anything, but it only takes a small amount of people to ruin it for everyone. So this drinking thing...
I got told off for... what was it? There was like just a couple of seeds on the top of a roll. Like I said, the kids to school...
Was someone peanut intolerant?
Well, or like they were worried that seeds. So, like, there was a couple of poppy seeds, and there might have been a sesame seed on the top of this, like just a couple on the top of this bun that I sent them in their sandwich, and I got hauled over the coals for daring to have a bun with a couple of seeds on top.
Absolute monster. So as long as
hummus as well. You can't have hummus in our school.
How do the middle classes survive?
I know exactly.
right. So it's not going to take many people to ruin this.
I do understand why, by the way, I was jesting.
I don't know, forget it.
I know if you have a serious sesame seed intolerance, I understand it's an issue. Anyway.
Yeah. I don't go to the games to watch the rugby. I don't remember anything which has happened in many games, unless I'm there to actually watch rugby as a, you know, a member of, quote unquote, the press at Sale Shark or something. I'm not watching the rugby. I'm there to enjoy the event, enjoy the day. Watching rugby is secondary to actually the experience of being there. Does anyone disagree with that?
I do enjoy watching the rugby, but I'm there for everything. So if I miss a few minutes of action, I don't mind too much.
No.
I'm there for the event and the day.
So and it is a day. It is getting some lovely little nibbles from M&S for the train and a few tins for the train. It's a couple in the pubs beforehand. Yes, it's a couple of Guinnesses during the game and some of those very expensive pork scratchings at Twickenham. and then it's more drinks afterwards. So, but yeah, I can understand if you were sat in front of someone who was relentlessly, like, say, 2, 3, or we'll say 4 times in a game, getting up and going, like...
I mean, that's 4 pints.
On mass.
Yeah, 4 pints in a game. That's good going. Yeah,
exactly. But if it's someone going in the middle of the first half to get a pint, going for a wee after 50 minutes, oh, come on. Let the boys play.
And there will be stories of people getting too drunk and spilling a pint on someone, or...
Of course.
And that is always... It's going to be annoying. If you have a pint spilt in your lap by some drunken oaf, that will be very, very annoying.
It happens. You know,
you can't, for every one of those stories, you can't ban people drinking pints. Yeah.
I would be furious. I think it's the most petty, ridiculous campaign that I've come across. Now, I'll give you 2 compromises. Have one part of the stadium sectioned off.
Yeah, fun zone.
The fun zone where you guys can go and watch the game, and maybe they can sell you a pencil sharpener with the ticket, so you know you can sharpen your pencil and take notes if that's what you enjoy. Right, you can do that. That's fine. The other compromise.
So that's the ironically named fun zone.
Yeah. The other compromise that I would make is you bring me the beer, right? So instead of me getting up, bring me the beer. But what I will not say is I do not want the bars closed during the game. And the other part of this is, why is it if I bought a box, I can have a beer at my leisure? Whereas because I'm sitting next to Mr. Grumpy, who wants the bar closed until half time, why is it then that I can't have a beer? And also, do we want everyone ploughing towards the bar at half time and then all coming back late? You'll just make the problem worse. It's a ridiculous idea.
They quite at the cricket, they have the people going around with those huge things on their back and they just fill up your drinks at your seat.
And Italy was the same, actually. They had like a cool box.
Yeah.
So, no. It's.
I will say, I was the Scotland-Wales game, a mate of mine WhatsApped me who goes to watch, he's a Chelsea season ticket holder, and he said, I love rugby. And he sent me a picture, and it was just a screenshot off the telly. And it was like, you saw a line out, and behind, you saw like 10 fans all in a row, and they all had 2 bottles of beer in their hands.
That's thoughtful. Yeah. Go back up, Dean.
But you're not even allowed to, in football, you're not even allowed to be within sight of the pitch with any alcohol.
No, not even corporate, you can't.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
So you can't see, you can't be in a position where you can look at the pitch and have any alcohol.
I do actually like the idea there. Well, do I like the idea? Basically, it's the same rule for everyone. You know, corporate or what have you, you can't drink and watch this game. And I'm not sure. Maybe pay enough if you can do what you want. I don't know.
I wonder if, and we like to talk about the values of rugby, I wonder whether this is partly that maybe the experience of the way that people behave at rugby games has maybe changed slightly in the last little while.
I hope it has changed a little bit because, you know, not everything back in the day was, you know, as good as it is now. So I would hope it had modernised.
I meant in the other sense. I meant that traditionally, in the way we always think of crowds of rugby fans is they will sink a load of drinks because that's just part of the day.
Yep.
But they will always stay good-humoured, respectful, to a degree. Always the odd idiot, don't get me wrong. And that was always the case. But generally speaking, when I think of rugby crowds and alcohol, I think good-humoured, respectful, fun, not crossing the line. But what I'm saying is, if there are lines being crossed more often, and that's been part of why people are starting to change the story, I don't know.
I think there's an element as well of, If you're determined to get annoyed about this, you'll be looking out for that more than you'll be looking out for the game. So if you're really upset about people getting up, if that's your chief bugbear, you know, you will count 50 people, whereas I will count none. And that's what's happening. And it's a part of this moralising of the game. Rugby values. Rugby values means whatever you've decided rugby values means in order to reinforce your point, depending on what topic you're talking about right now.
And I can...
That's all more, I don't... Other than left-handed drinking, I don't really know what a rugby value is.
I can relate this to gigs slightly, which is obviously something, you know, big. You know, you've been to tons of gigs yourself.
I love a good gig. Yeah, it's true.
But there are some people that go to a gig, and it's certain types of bands and stuff that you'll go and see that get people that aren't used to going to gigs, and they get annoyed with you when you squeeze past them to get in front of them. But basically, the rule is at a concert, at a gig, it's fair game. Whether someone jumps up and down to get past you, or whether someone just pushes past, says, excuse me, and just goes in, it's fair game, free for all. If you can get closer to the stage than me, go for it.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Sounds carnage.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, more and more I retreat towards the back and watch from a safe distance.
Yeah. You're not moshing these days, Tim.
Not these days, mate.
I've got a good friend called CJ who... in his youth, loved to mosh. He sends us these videos. What for me?
It's good rugby training. You just take the Toc H forwards down.
I remember...
to a death metal gig.
I remember going to Tea in the Park about probably 12, 13 years ago, and Prodigy were on.
Oh my goodness.
On Sunday, and I did some moshing then. That was good. That was very, very drunk on a Sunday night.
Just drunk?
Just drunk.
Yeah, so I'm saying more Negronis in stadiums. I think if you don't want to, you know. And by the way, you are in no position to tell me I'm not a real rugby fan because I enjoy drinking at stadiums. No position. Anyone who does is a moron. The moron.
But let's be respectful of those people that don't like it and
I don't know what to do about that.
A part of the ground.
Yeah, I mean,
the fun zone. Get it done.
Yeah, fun zone. Let's get the fun zone and we'll put badges on them so we know not to talk to them in public.
Even if I wasn't drinking, I would...
I'd pretend to drink.
I would want to be around a bunch of rugby fans that are merry. Quite often the chat, the banter between groups of fans and stuff is... you're right, I pay very little attention to the game for chunks of it.
Yeah. How did we do it for the repertoire? It was three of us.
I don't remember the game. What was the score?
I couldn't tell you. We did it respectful way, which we went and bought a jug every time, so we didn't have to get up too often. You know, it's fine. It's particularly if you're in a round of drinks or so on and so forth. So, yeah, we've canned that. Let's not bring it back, please. It's done. It's over.
Right. Any other business? Final section. I'd just like to say, you know how when they change the clocks, as they will be doing soon?
Mm-hmm.
Is it like next weekend or something?
The weekend after, when we lose an hour's sleep.
End of
March.
Spring forward. Yeah.
Why don't they do that? Instead of at 2 a.m, why don't they do it at like 4 p.m. on a Friday?
Oh, that's smart.
Wouldn't that be better? Everyone would love it.
Yeah.
Like suddenly...
Hang on.
Home time.
Is that how it'd work?
Yeah, well, when it springs forward, it would be at 4 p.m. Nice. Right? Yes. Let's go home.
That's a vote winner. I would run as an independent group MP on that.
You have more substance in policy than they've currently got.
Brilliant. That's some good any other business. I wonder if I have anything interesting to that. No, I don't.
Me neither.
Excellent. Right, wrap this up, Tim. Let's go home.
Right. Subscribe, follow, listen, share. Let the boys play.
Let the boys play.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.